From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After years of refusing to perform his hits, John Fogerty is singing them again. Fogerty was the lead singer and songwriter of the band Creedence Clearwater Revival. Their hits from the late 60s and early 70s include Bad Moon Rising, Proud Mary, and Born on the Bayou. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Fogerty and listen to his new live CD featuring new versions of his old songs. Also today, turning art into a cash crop. We'll hear how the Mizen people of Papua New Guinea are trying to sell tribal art as an alternative to the deals they've been offered by companies who want to log and develop the rainforest. We'll hear from tribal leader John Wesley Vasso and curator Larry Rinder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. California voters are at the polls today deciding two closely watched ballot initiatives. One would end the state's bilingual education programs. The other would force unions to ask the permission of their members before spending money on political causes. Voters will also get closer to choosing their new governor. The three leading Democrats who hope to succeed retiring Republican Governor Pete Wilson are Lieutenant Governor Gray Davis, Congresswoman Jane Hartman, and former Northwest Airlines co-chairman Al Checchi. Attorney General Dan Lundgren is expected to win the GOP nomination. New Mexico is holding its primary today. An open congressional seat is up for grabs. Tom Trowbridge of member station KUNM has this report.
Voters in New Mexico's first congressional district will determine candidates for the House seat left open by the death of Republican Congressman Steve Schiff. Schiff died of cancer in March. State Senator Phil Maloof is expected to get the Democratic nomination, while Heather Wilson, a former state cabinet secretary, is favored for the GOP nod. Both Maloof and Wilson will face off in a separate election in 3 weeks to complete Schiff's term. Also, six Democrats are seeking to challenge Republican incumbent Governor Gary Johnson. Former Albuquerque Mayor Martin Chavez is the clear front runner. For NPR News, I'm Tom Trowbridge in Santa Fe.
The space shuttle Discovery is being prepared for a launch into space tonight. It will ferry goods to the Russian space station Mir. Perfect weather is forecast for the launch. Engineers almost delayed it because of another set of steering problems with Mir. The steering system failed and the station drifted for 3 days, but cosmonauts were able to restart the station's thrusters needed to keep the space station steady as the shuttle gets closer. Russian President Boris Yeltsin met today with leading industrialists and bankers. He scolded them for their lack of faith in Russia's faltering markets. David McGuffin reports from Moscow.
Today's meeting between Boris Yeltsin and Russia's 10 leading businessmen turned into a lecture by the Russian president. He told the businessmen that when domestic investors like them don't put their money into the Russian economy, foreign investors react immediately. This remark was aimed especially at the country's banks. Analysts say heavy selling by Russian banks was behind most of Monday's 10% drop on the Moscow Stock Exchange. Coming out of the meeting, the leading bankers said they had agreed to form a commission with the government on how to restore faith in Russia's markets. In the past month, the markets here have dropped 44%, but today the markets rebounded, up 12%. Brokers say it was mostly bolstered by persistent rumors here that the United States and Germany will help prop up Russia's struggling currency. For NPR News, I'm David McGuffin in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 38 points at 88.84. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, in the stock market, shares of high technology seem to be doing better after yesterday's big declines. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
After a nearly 2% drop yesterday, the technology-heavy Nasdaq exchange seems to be doing better at midday. Blue-chip stocks, however, have turned lower despite the release of more upbeat economic news today. Commerce Department reports sales of new homes rose by 5.2% in April. The index of leading economic indicators, considered a key gauge of the economy 6 to 9 months down the road, was also higher, rising 0.1%. Finally, stock at number three long-distance company Sprint was up on news from the company today. It has spent $2 billion already to upgrade its telephone network. Sprint says business and residential customers will be able to have fax, voice, and internet capability all on one phone line. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A lawmaker is chiding the government for failing to prepare enough for the year 2000 computer problem. Congressman Stephen Horn chairs a House Government Management Subcommittee. He's given the Pentagon a D and the Transportation Department an F for their efforts to solve the Millennium Bug. Horn says agencies must do more to fix problems expected to be caused by their computers' inability to tell the year 2000 from the year 1900. The computers only use the last two digits to represent a year. But Horn gave the Social Security Administration an A for its work. Philadelphia commuters are struggling with a mass transit strike. More than 5,000 workers are off their jobs. Contract issues at stake include cuts in wages and benefits for new workers, an increase in health insurance co-payments, and a change to work rules. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Fogerty, was the lead singer and songwriter with the band Creedence Clearwater Revival. Between 1968 and 72, the year Creedence broke up, they had several gold records as well as eight top 10 singles, including Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, Green River, Down on the Corner, and Looking Out My Back Door. For many years, Fogerty refused to perform the songs that made him famous because his old record company owned the rights to those songs. But Fogerty returns to those songs on his new live CD, Premonition. VH1 will air an hour-long tribute to Fogerty, followed by the concert which is featured on the CD. It will be shown June 10th, 12th, 14th, and 27th. Before we meet Fogerty, let's hear one of his signature songs, the song which opens his new CD, Premonition. John Fogerty from his new CD, Premonition. John Fogerty, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. Hello.
The songs on this CD are songs that, you haven't been performing for years. What are the reasons why you didn't perform your old Creedence songs for so long?
Got a minute?
Yeah.
Actually, they're pretty well-known reasons. I had an awful lot of trouble with the first record company, the record company that Creedence Clearwater recorded for, which was Fantasy Records in the Bay Area. And even though the band broke up, they owned my contract. And I ended up with lots of legal fees and being in court all the time and suing. And, it was just kind of a nightmare. And all of that got attached in my mind or in my being to the very songs I had written. It becomes a situation where the thing that you love most also becomes the thing that caused you the most pain, and it's really hard to deal with. So for many years, I tried to divorce myself from my own legacy, you might say, from my own life's work, but that was the reasons for not doing the songs. And then much later, a lot more recently, really, I had a kind of, I want to say premonition, but that wasn't exactly it. But I came to a point where I had healed emotionally to enough to where I felt like reconnecting with my own past.
Did you miss the songs in the years that you were in singing them? I know that there was a lot of negative stuff attached in your mind to those songs and a lot of contested money. On the bright side, a lot of performers who are best known for their work from the late 60s and early 70s are sick and tired of those songs and feel so sorry that they're forced to do it whenever they perform. Whereas I'm sure for you, those songs are really exciting and fresh to do now.
Yeah, very much so. It may be something like the famous Muhammad Ali rope-a-dope, where I was saving myself, you know, for later rounds or something. I enjoy, well, these songs are so much a part of me. They reflect my personality and things that I love so much. I still feel that way. I'm, you know, Proud Mary very much reflects my love of Americana, a time, let's say, during Mark Twain's era, when there was a lot of romance about the West and the Mississippi and that sort of thing. I tend to romanticize things, but, you know, that a little of that can go a long way.
Do I understand that you spent some time in the Mississippi Delta while preparing your previous album? What impact did that have on you and on writing new songs and thinking about your old songs?
Well, as a matter of fact, the fact that I became emotionally healthy and more willing to do my old material is a direct result of those visits to Mississippi. And it's a really strange thing. I mean, this isn't something I totally understand, but I'm really glad it happened. I started getting this very strong urge to go to Mississippi around 1988. And I ignored the call, you might say. I couldn't understand why I was feeling like I should go. I didn't have a clue what I would do when I got there. Like I say, I just kept putting off the urge, but the urge was very clear and very strong. So I finally went for the first time in 1989, I think. And I still didn't know why I was going, but eventually what happened was I found myself at the mythical gravesite of Robert Johnson. There was no big neon sign or anything. You had to kind of weed through folklore and a lot of, you know, books and stuff to figure it out. But I got to where I felt he was probably buried, and there was a tree that's in the stories that you hear. Anyway, while I was standing there and pondering Robert, I started wondering who owned his songs. In other words, Robert is gone, but the songs live on, and they are great songs. And for some reason, it was a curiosity to me. Well, I wonder who owns these songs. And finally, I decided it doesn't matter who owns the songs. Robert owns the songs. You know, I'm standing here where these songs came from, and I'm standing here at Robert's resting place. And as far as I'm concerned, Robert Johnson is the spiritual owner of his songs. And this is a long, kind of a long anecdote to say that the minute that thought passed through my mind, I realized there was a great parallel with myself. You know, I'd come a long way to visit Robert's grave. And I thought, wow, you know, this is kind of like me, except it would be a shame if, you know, 50 years from now, some guy's standing at my gravesite going, gee, I wonder whatever happened to John Fogerty. I wonder who owns his songs. And then that guy would probably say, it doesn't matter, John is the spiritual owner. And the minute I realized that there was a bit of tragedy in all of that, I started thinking I should do something about my own connection with my songs. After all, I am the spiritual owner of my songs. And most other people from the outside think of me as the owner, regardless of the real legal or financial ramifications.
You've written a lot of songs inspired by the South, like Born on the Bayou. You were actually born in El Cerrito, California, near Berkeley. And I'm wondering why in some of your songs you wrote first person in the persona of a Southerner.
Gee, that's a good question. I think I was trying to place myself in this mythicized and romanticized territory. It's a mythical world, kind of, that I created. Certainly, musically, it's a mythical world. And why I use the device of first person, I think I realized that talking about the main street of El Cerrito probably wasn't going to be something that was widely understood or even cared about. It didn't seem very interesting to me anyway, and the South has always fascinated me, and that's really the reason, the reason that I placed myself that way in my own songs. But if you want to ask me why am I so fascinated about the South, I really have to confess I don't know.
Because of the music?
Most of what I know about the South came through music, particularly the early forms of rock and roll, meaning rhythm and blues, and country music. And again, all those versions, I believe, were pretty romanticized. They, they were sort of rainbow-colored visions of the South in most cases.
Would your father have ever said what the father says in Born on the Bayou? Papa said, "Son, don't let the man get you and do what he done to me."
Yeah, he did say that a few different ways. My dad was a dreamer, unfortunately. He wasn't much of he didn't find great success in this world. But he was quite a dreamer and pretty literate. He read all the time and he was inspired by all kinds of people that he passed on to me in kind of little snippets. I can remember when I was very, very young, my father reading the story of Dangerous Dan McGrew over and over. He loved that particular poem. He really loved Ernest Hemingway. He was a product of the 30s and 40s, I guess. My parents certainly were Depression-era people, and I learned a lot of those lessons at their knee. And I think just by the way my dad ended up living his life, just by example, really, he was telling me, don't let the man get you and do what he done to me.
John Fogerty, do me a favor. Can you say two words for me, turning and burning?
Well, when I'm sitting here quietly in a library atmosphere, it is turning and burning. But when I sing, it always comes out toinen and boinen.
Yeah, I know. That's very New Orleans, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I didn't know where, really. Although I've noticed, because I just did it naturally. When I wrote the words, I wrote them to sound that way.
And the song in question is Proud Mary. Yeah.
Right. I've also noticed, though, that Howlin' Wolf has very much that sort of dialect in his music. I only spoke to him a couple times, but in his singing, in the great songs that he did, he pronounces those words that way. But yes, down in New Orleans, a lot of people will say toinen and boinen.
Well, why don't we pause here and listen to your new recording of Proud Mary from your new album, Premonition. My guest is John Fogerty.
Waking by the man every night and day, and I never lost a minute of sleep, and worrying about the
John Fogerty from his new CD, Premonition. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Fogerty. On his new CD, he does the songs that he first recorded with Creedence Clearwater Revival. The members of Creedence started performing together, I think, in 1959 when you were all in high school. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Actually, we were still in the eighth grade, three of us.
Junior high school.
Right.
What were your early songs? What was the band like back in eighth grade?
Well, we were mostly an instrumental band. I patterned myself and my band very much around Duane Eddy, and we did several Duane Eddy instrumentals. We also had probably 10 or more instrumentals that I had written, not remarkably original, really, but, I would play, taking the pattern basically from Duane, I would play the melody on the guitar, and Stu, who was not yet playing bass, was playing piano, and I had kind of showed him the rudiments of, three-note chords and a little bass line. So at that level of our development, we were certainly learning the rudiments of music, but always with a rock and roll flair, you might say. Rock and roll has some pretty strict parameters that you... When you step outside those parameters, everyone kind of gives you that crossed finger look, like they're holding back a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always kind of based everything from the center of rock and roll.
The band's first name was Tommy Fogerty. That's your brother, Tommy Fogerty and the Blue Velvets, and then the band was called. What was the second name?
Well, actually, originally, the three of us were the same age in the eighth grade, so we were just the Blue Velvets.
Oh.
And then we got the lucky happenstance to make a few records for a little local Bay Area label, and under that guise, Tom would join us. Tom, by that point, I think was out of high school, and of course, we were still in high school. And, under that recording name, we were Tommy Fogerty and the Blue Velvets.
And then what was the next name that you used?
The next name on records was the Gollywogs.
And what was the Gollywogs supposed to mean?
Well, this is one of those deals because you're young and everybody else is supposedly older and wiser, and it's their record company. What the real story is, we worked on the first song for about 9 months. I mean, we had gone in there and recorded it, and we kept pressuring the record company to, when's it coming out? This is all of 1964. And then finally they tell us, well, the record's here, the pressings are here. So we rush over. Actually, I rushed over to San Francisco, and I pull one. It's your first real record on a supposedly national label, Fantasy Records, and you want to look at this thing. And you take it out of the box, and I looked at it, and oh, my God, it said The Gollywogs. So Max was one of the brothers that owned the company then. I said, well, geez, Max, there's a mistake here. There's like a typo. They put The Gollywogs. No, we decided to rename you guys. Oh, well, why? See, a gollywog is in England, a gollywog is like a voodoo doll. It's this doll that comes from Africa. It's really a hip thing. It's really cool. And it's black, too. It's like from the black culture. And it's really cool. It's like a voodoo doll. And in England, it's really a hip thing. Of course, in 1964, the British had arrived in America, and all things English and British, mod, et cetera, were very cool. Unfortunately, no one in England had ever heard of a gollywog either.
How did you come up with the name Creedence Clearwater Revival?
Well, of course, after struggling under that name for several years, the ownership of Fantasy changed. And the very first thing we wanted to do was change our name. And the guy that had bought the company, the new owner of the company, agreed with us that we could change the name. I think he hated it too. And so we set about for many months trying to come up with a name, but none of it was very suitable or remarkable. The whole process started to bog down. I think it was Christmas Eve, and I was watching television, and two commercials came on television, one of which was a beer commercial that really promoted its use of the water, and they were showing this lush green woods and this flowing river, and you know, it was, the place looked enchanted, and there was this beautiful music in the background. And right after that was a black and white commercial. It was an anti-pollution commercial, and it showed all kinds of pollution and garbage in the water and that sort of thing. And at the end it said, if you want to change things, write to Clean Water Washington. And I was really taken by the two things back to back, the beautiful clear water and the, you know, terrible polluted water. And clean water stuck in my mind. I started playing with that. Clean water didn't seem like a very good name for a band, but I evolved to clear water. And I remembered back to when we had toyed at some point with the name Creedence. It's not true that I ever knew this person there, but we did know of a man whose first name was Creedence. Pretty unusual name. And, of course, I shuffled that around. Clearwater, Creedence, Creedence, Clearwater. Oh, I kind of like that. But it still didn't sound complete. Remember, this is during the era of Jefferson Airplane and Strawberry Alarm Clock and Buffalo Springfield. So I kept playing around with different words, and I thought that what we were really doing was having a revival. The group. We'd been together a long time, but we were now experiencing a revival, or at least I hoped so. So finally, after about probably 10 minutes of thought or even less, I had come up with the name. And I must say that the name was much better than we were at the time.
John Fogarty, he'll be back in the second half of the show. His new CD is called Premonition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a tribal culture in Papua New Guinea that is trying to sell its art as an alternative to selling out to companies that want to develop the rainforest. We'll hear from tribal leader John Wesley Vasso and curator Larry Rinder. And we hear more from John Fogarty.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Fogerty. He's best known as the former lead singer and songwriter with Creedence Clearwater Revival. On his new CD, Premonition, he does new versions of the hits he had with Creedence, including Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, and Born on the Bayou. Creedence Clearwater Revival had its biggest hits between 1968 and 1972, a bunch of top 10 hits. And you were based in the Bay Area around San Francisco. San Francisco at that time was dominated, you know, in the public mind by groups like the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead, the kind of psychedelic bands. Where did you see Creedence fitting into that California scene of the time?
Well, since I had grown up so much with a fondness for blues and R&B and particularly rock and roll, my work ethic, you might say, was somewhat different than what I perceived the work ethic, if you can even use that term, of people like the Grateful Dead. And so I noticed that our music or our approach to music was, or at least mine, was far different than the other bands that were becoming famous in San Francisco. But politically, I felt very much as part of the feeling of people in the Bay Area or San Francisco, or really my generation in general.
You wrote some politicized songs that pertain to the draft and to the war in Vietnam, like Fortunate Son, which is a song about how privileged people make wars, but the sons of the privileged are exempt from fighting them. And Who'll Stop the Rain, I think, was perceived as an anti-Vietnam song. I know you were in the reserves for a while. How did you end up in the reserves?
I was a very lucky guy, really. A local sergeant in a reserve unit took pity on me and basically let me join his unit when, the unit was full and there was really no place for me to go. He basically took pity on me and let me get into his reserve unit at the time.
So what year was that you were drafted?
1966.
So you were already recording then?
Oh, yeah.
And you didn't want to go to Vietnam, so you ended up in the reserves. I'm wondering if being in the reserves affected your attitude toward the war or toward the kinds of songs you wanted to write.
Oh, I would say very much, because, you quickly learn when you become a grunt in the military that you're just a number, you're just a piece of meat, you're nothing. You have no rights, you have no privileges, you have no power over what happens to you. And that's a very debilitating feeling. And I can remember the night I finally arrived at my boot camp after being shuffled around for a couple of days, really. And it's your first day, and they keep you awake forever. You seem like you've been awake. And somewhere around midnight or 1 in the morning, all my guys got marched off to get our hair cut. And you kind of come back, you feel like you've been sexually abused. You know, they say, okay, go back in there. And you go back in your barracks, and there's like 30 other people in the same boat, and you're all a bunch of ugly eggheads. And I laid down on my bunk, and I must confess a few, my eyes certainly watered, is I guess what I'm trying to say. Of course, you get over that because you're supposed to be a man. It was probably the most forlorn feeling I've ever had.
Did you see your song, Who'll Stop the Rain, as an anti-war song?
Yes.
Why don't we play that now? We'll play the new version from your new concert album, Premonition. Do you want to say anything about writing this song before we hear it?
Well, of course, the rain is a metaphor for the gobbledygook that comes down from the places on high. And I was feeling pretty much powerless at the time I wrote this song. And I was trying to reflect that really it seems to be, it has gone on since the beginning of time. And even at the time of the Vietnam War, when there was so much protest in the air, I had a very fatalistic point of view. It seemed like all the protesting in the world wasn't going to change anything.
This is Who'll Stop the Rain from John Fogerty's new album, Premonition.
Long as I remember, the rain been coming down. Clouds of mystery pouring, confusion on the ground. Good men through the ages try to find the sun. And I wonder, who'd stop the rain? I went down Virginia, seeking shelter from the storm.
John Fogerty, a new recording of his song, Who'll Stop the Rain, on his new album, Premonition. Did you hear from people who were fighting in Vietnam that they played your records there a lot and that your records mattered to them while they were in the jungle?
I would hear that off and on right around the time of 1970, 71, but I heard about it a lot more later, as I began to become an adult, and guys who were now back and settled into the community would tell me all kind of stories about Vietnam and the music that they experienced there.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, in some cases, it was very uplifting. I am proud that the songs meant so much. I realized, of course, that all the music at the time meant so much, and especially to Americans off in a foreign land, in a jungle, fighting for their life. I mean, anything, these are kids, these are guys 20 and 21 years old. Anything that is a touch of home is a very welcome memory at that time.
The records that we've heard today are all new versions of your early songs. On your new CD, you have one new song that you haven't recorded before called Premonition. And I'd like to end with that recording. Would you tell us something about the song?
In my mind, this is just a rock and roll song. It's not really from personal life, on my part anyway. It was, at least to me, a really fun song to play live. It was a good vehicle for the band to play in front of people, and it was something you could get right away. It was a song that wasn't, you know, real difficult to get on one or two or listenings, and that's really what I was after.
John Fogerty, a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you very much and wish you good luck with the new CD.
Thank you so much.
John Fogerty from his new CD, Premonition. Coming up, a tribal culture selling art instead of selling the rights to develop the rainforest. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ tribal cultures are faced with the ultimate dilemma, how to exist in the contemporary world while still maintaining their traditions. Take the Mizen, for instance, a tribal culture in Papua New Guinea. They've received financial offers from companies that want to buy the rights to log and develop the rainforest. The Mizen have refused the offers because their whole way of life revolves around the rainforest. But they've been looking for alternate ways to raise the money they need for things like health care and education. One alternative is to sell their tribal art, tapis. Tapis is a cloth made of bark, which is painted in ritualistic or decorative patterns. The Mizen have had several tapis exhibits in the U.S. and are even discussing distribution with a well-known catalog company. The Fabric Workshop and Museum in Philadelphia recently brought in several Mizen artists. Their art will be exhibited through June 22nd. My guests are John Wesley Vasso, who is secretary of the Mizen's Conservation and Development Group, and Larry Rinder, the guest curator of the Philadelphia exhibition and curator of an earlier show in Berkeley. Larry Rinder traveled to the Mizen land. I asked him to describe how it looked to him as an outsider.
Well, it was quite extraordinary coming in. I expected an adventure, and I wasn't disappointed. It's quite long and arduous process to get to the Mizen lands. You fly through Australia, then you come into Port Moresby, which is a rather rough and tumble town. And then you have to fly in a small plane, and I have a fear of flying. So I, with great trepidation, I got into this tiny little plane, and off we go over the spine of New Guinea, which goes up to about 12,000 feet, the mountains there, and which sometimes have snow on them, despite the fact of being very close to the equator. And you come down the other side, and we sort of dive bombed the runway to get the cows off of it once, and then finally landed. From there, you get in a dinghy, a motorized dinghy that goes through the ocean about an hour. There are no roads into the Mizen lands, and some of the Mizen people who can't afford the fuel or don't have boats will actually walk for hours through the mangrove swamps, but we weren't prepared to do that. So we came in our dinghy and surfed in into the mouth of a river, and there are these beautiful palm trees, and you can see the houses, which are on stilts and have beautiful thatched roofs. And I saw along the river they had built a beautiful ceremonial gateway made of palm fronds with flowers attached to it. But at first I couldn't see any people there, and suddenly a group of men dressed as warriors came through this gate and with great vim and vigor proceeded to hurl spears at our little boat. And I had been standing up snapping pictures with my camera and suddenly fell backwards into the boat, and everyone laughed and had a great time. I learned later that this was the ceremonial way to welcome people to the village, only they usually don't throw the spears.
Did you think you were about to sacrifice your life for art?
Yes, I did.
John Wesley, can you explain that tradition to us of welcoming people with spears?
Well, that's been part and parcel of our life and the tradition and our culture in our society. And that is how the people are really committed to the type of the welcome that we're really looking forward to, and the people who are coming. This is our respect for the guests who will be coming. So this is really
good. But he thought you were trying to kill him.
No. I think he admits that in actual fact, people told him it was just a way of a form of welcoming our guests into our site, in our community.
Now, John Wesley, you are the secretary for a group known as MICAD, and that stands for the Mizen Integrated Conservation and Development Group.
That's right.
And so you're one of the intermediaries here in deciding what to do when someone like Larry comes to the village and makes a request, we want some art. I believe that selling art has become one of the alternatives you've come up with to selling the trees. I mean, you've had a lot of big money offers from loggers who wanted to come into your village, which is in a rainforest, and cut down the trees. And you said no to that. Your community said no to the loggers. Why?
Well, there are various reasons behind our say no to logging and the monster called development. And because there were reasons being that our wildlife would be affected, the forest. I mean, when people take away the forest, we would have our wildlife that would be
taken away in that. And the timber will also be taken away with which we are able to build our houses and, of course, provide our own firewood out of. We don't have gas stoves and all that. That is a part and parcel of our livelihood. And, of course, our freshwater streams would be polluted because of logging. And most of all, we would not want to give away our heritage. It's been passed on from generation to generation, and that is the utmost important, the reason why we want to maintain the forest.
Now, is there a line between what you're willing to sell in traditional art and the kind of art that you want to just keep within the community, art that's perhaps too sacred to be marketed?
Well, we have our clan designs and art within our own clans. There are 36 clans in the community, and each individual clan holds on to his own clan designs and art. This one, the one that we are trying to sell, the art, is the everyday artwork that is put on the tapa out of person's artist's own mind, transformed on the tapa itself. So it's not taking away the sacredness of the culture and the actual artwork.
So is there actually some kind of law in your community that you can't sell the clan designs?
Well, there is no law that says we cannot, but the whole thing is it is sacred. It belongs to the clan, and it will stay a clan heritage. It will never be exchanged. Within the Meissen community, the society, one clan does not clan heritage and clan art and design is not transferable.
Now, I understand that there hasn't been a word in your language for art. Is that right?
Well, in my last visit to the community, I asked a lot of people this question, and as best as I could determine, there isn't a word for art exactly that corresponds to our word, but there is this word saraman. Yeah. Which, and Saruman, as far as I can determine, means a combination of thinking and doing, a confluence of thinking and doing. And when they talk about tapa making is Saruman. It is something that exemplifies Saruman, thinking and doing. But only the non-clan designs, the clan designs which are conventional, that is, the design is repeated generation after generation, these are not Saruman, because they don't require thinking to do. The design is known in advance. So it's because the tapa of the type that we have at the fabric workshop, or the types that are being done in the new fabrics, because the artist is thinking in the process of doing. There's a kind of a concentration. It is saraman. And I think that actually it's a much more subtle evocation of the creative process than our word for art. Our word for art is actually, our word art is pretty clunky and indeterminate, and this seems much more refined.
Larry, as a curator of contemporary art exhibitions, mm-hmm. you mostly deal with living Western artists. Many of these artists, I'm sure, take a fairly intellectualized, analytical approach to their art. What has it been like for you to work with a tribal tradition mm-hmm. of art? Has it changed your personal sense of what art is, or the place you want art to have in your personal life, or mm-hmm. your community life, or your professional life?
Yeah. Well, actually, in terms of on the level of aesthetic production or intellectualization, I don't find the attitude of the Meissen artists that different from, say, abstract painters in the West. What's the connection?
Mm-hmm.
If you ask a Meissen artist, where does this come from? They say it comes free. It's from my imagination. I know painters, and they don't particularly like to talk about it. They don't like to go beyond that in terms of saying what the inspiration is. I know artists, one of my favorite artists, her studio is on Chamber Street in New York City. She could say the same thing. It could be the same sort of description, the same hesitancy to apply words or analysis to the process. For me personally, one of the things that I would say is most transforming about this experience is that when I first went to the village in preparation for the Berkeley exhibition, one of the things they said was, they said, in our culture, you don't just come in and do something and then leave and that's it. When you make a commitment, it's a commitment for, you know, for life. It's a commitment from your heart. And this is completely antithetical to the way things are done in Western society, particularly in the art world. The way my exhibition work had been going, I think by the time I got to the Meisen, I had done probably 50 exhibitions with 50 different artists from all over the world. I'd meet them, we'd work intensely, and then, you know, that would be it. And so I was sort of taken aback by this and really had to reflect on what that meant. And here I am again with them 5 years later. So far, so good.
My guests are curator Larry Rinder and Meisen tribal leader John Wesley Vasso. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are John Wesley Vasso, and he is from the Meisen tribe in Papua New Guinea. And the tribe is now marketing some of their art to the West, and this is an alternative to raising money through logging the rainforest that they live in. And Larry Rinder is with me as well. He's director of exhibitions and public programs at the California College of Arts and Crafts. He curated an exhibition of Meisner art in California, and he also curated the exhibition at the Fabric Workshop and Museum in Philadelphia. Larry, our art and commerce are always a little controversial when they come together, and they're coming together in a very interesting way in the Meisen community, because the Meisen are using art as a way of funding the community and as one of the alternatives to selling out the rainforest to loggers. And I'm wondering what you think of this intersection of art and commerce in a traditional context.
Right. Well, I think it's really fascinating. There is a double standard in the worlds of museum practice and in terms of the art market. That is to say, for Western art, for something to be valued as art, it has to be useless. It has to be something that is just intended for sort of pure aesthetic delectation. And generally speaking, it's something that needs to have been made for the market. Otherwise, it's craft or untrained art or something like this. It gets some sort of lesser denotation. For non-Western arts, it's precisely the opposite. For something to be art, it has to be to end up in a museum or to have this sort of great value placed on it. It has to have been something that is useful, something that was made for say a carved canoe or for a sacred use, for example, and it can't have been made for a commercial reason. So it's actually the absolute opposite. And I think that the world is becoming a much too complex place, a much too hybridized for us to maintain this distinction any longer. I mean, it really is an odd distinction to begin with, and I think at this point it's something that is just not useful any longer.
Is this changing your idea of what the definition of art should be or how art should be valued in the marketplace?
Yes, absolutely.
How?
When the Meisen came to Berkeley and we were conducting market research and we were faced with the question of where is the market niche for these tapa cloth paintings? Is it as tourist art? Is it something we want to sort of put in airport shops? Is it something that's best for museum stores? Or is it something that we could market as fine art? Do we price these things at $10 or $10,000? Because there was virtually no exposure of this material in the West, we had this whole range of opportunities, and it immediately raised the philosophical question, you know, what is this? What is the value of this material as art, as craft, as you know, what have you? And the decision ultimately was based more on what was best for the community than on how we're going to define it in the West. That is to say, in conversation with the Mizen representatives who came over, we decided that if the value of the individual pieces were too high, say in the $1,000 to $10,000 range, that would create a kind of an inequity in the community. It would perhaps create the kind of star system or celebrity status that you talked about and would endanger community stability. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we didn't want to place the value so low that it just demeaned the practice. And so we came to a sort of an intermediate level. And I think that that's fascinating to sort of establish the definition of what kind of art this is based on the community's needs.
John Wesley, I understand one of the things you wanted to see while you were in the United States was a car factory, and you were taken to the Chrysler plant, to a Chrysler plant. Why did you want to go there?
Well, we've heard so much about the cars being made in the States, and we decided that we'd go and see the automobile factory. And, it was really fascinating, amazing at how many cars were turned over in a matter of day. And it was really interesting to note how, you know, instead of the man working, it was the robots working. And even before we got to the finished part of the plant, the cars that we had seen, you know, being assembled had already been, you know, gone through the process and were parked outside. And when we came back, they just opened the door, went in, and were just looking at the cars, and it was really amazing how many cars these people could make. They said it was about 48 cars in an hour.
Are there any cars in your village?
No roads, no cars. Maybe one day.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
John Wesley Vasso is a Mizen tribal leader. Larry Rinder guest curated the Mizen exhibition at the Fabric Workshop and Museum in Philadelphia. Our program was produced today by Kathy Wolf and Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth and Tracy Tenenbaum. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Jane Alexander looks back at her tenure as head of the National Endowment for the Arts. And we'll talk to Bill Ivey, the new head of the NEA and former head of the Country Music Foundation. The foundation has just produced a CD box set of African Americans in country music. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.